Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares to listen. This is the Main Turton, John Lash, recording on Thursday, the 17th of January, 2013, and the title of this recording is Kalki Avatar. This is a rather unusual recording I'm making today. It's not a nav briefing, although it might pass as one. Rather, I'm doing it in order to get back in touch with you all, those who listen to me, those who follow my recorded talks and teachings, whether you be members of the GNE crew or not. Some of you have written me saying that you miss hearing my voice. I'm not quite ready to come forth with a nav briefing or to complete the series of talks on Gnostic sabotage in the apocalypse. But I thought it might be appropriate and it might be considerate of you all if I gave you the chance to hear my voice and to do so in this unique instance by reading to you a text. The text I'm going to read can be found on metahistory.org under the title Goddess to the Rescue. And this text was written and posted on the 5th of March, 2012. I think it's almost the last thing, or perhaps the last thing, that I had written on metahistory.org. So the content of this recording will be my reading of the text. And if you'd like to, you can go to the site and follow the reading, because there are a number of striking illustrations posted with the article that you may want to review, or if you haven't read this article, you may want to consider those illustrations for the first time. So, here it comes. Goddess to the Rescue, with a question mark. The Kalki Avatar in Sophianic Perspective. The opening citation is from Nietzsche, from Thus Spake Zarathustra, written in 1885. Quote, untroubled, scornful, outrageous, this is how wisdom wants us to be. She is a woman who never loves anyone but a warrior. End quote. Hindu myth, recorded in the Puranas and elsewhere, describes an immense cosmic scenario of the dreaming god, Vishnu. It is said that Vishnu, the cosmic dreamer, appears on 10 occasions in his own dream, which is life as we know it. These are the 10 avatars, or incarnations, of Vishnu. The image shows Vishnu dreaming beneath the hood of the many-headed serpent of eternity, Ananta. Aeons may be regarded as massive torrents of living plasma, organic light, capable of observing the cosmic environment. The serpents overlooking the dreamer may represent the attendants of the entire pleromic company, witnesses to the dream scenario underway. The eyes of the Ananta snakes are open, that is, observing, witnessing, while Vishnu's eyes are closed, that is to say, dreaming, emanating. The myth theme of the dreaming god is a variant of world mythology called Oniric myth, from the Greek oneros, meaning dream. Dream is to be understood in this sense, neither as a make-believe alternative to reality, fostering escapism for those who cannot face life as it is, nor as a collectively assumed false notion or false narrative, the myth of American dominance, for instance. True myth is neither fantasy nor falsity. When it is genuine, myth presents a testable description of actions and events that transpire beyond the scale of human perception. Practice with myth can expand the scope and depth of perception to encompass what it describes. In the Gnostic method consistent with the Sophianic vision story, Myth is the narrative that engages human awareness with the immense imaginative projections of the divine, to the point of interactivity with the very source of life, mind, and matter. Maya is not illusion, as is widely presumed, but the actual materialization of an imagined world, e.g., the dreaming of Vishnu. In visionary practice with myth, we awaken to reality as lucid dreamers. Doing so, we realize that we are characters living in a real-life 4D movie sustained by immanent divinity. In this perspective, human beings are not merely biological creatures produced by a supposed creator God. We are biological creatures, real-life animals for sure, and that is no illusion. Additional to that, we are flesh and blood characters acting in a living dream, capable of direct interaction with the source of that dream. In the particular Gnostic variant of Asian oniric myth, the cosmic dreamer of the human world on the planet Earth is the Aeon Sophia, and she is herself the immanent divinity embodied in this planet. She is the source and setting for our life, and her story is the framework for direction of life, proving or providing a transpersonal aim for each and every single human individual. In the mysteries, the Teleste taught the three S's: source, setting, story. Intervention scenario. The Sophianic vision story of the mysteries is a paramount creation myth of unique and exceptional features. It is the sole version of oniric myth that enables individual members of the imaginatively gifted human species to engage directly with the origin of our species and of the earth itself. Sophianic myth is the only narrative in the entire inventory of world mythology that roots human NLP to the immediate cosmic source of life, mind, and sensation. Sophia, whose name means wisdom, is that source. In Gnostic cosmology, a divinity of the cosmic level of Sophia, originating from the core of the Milky Way galaxy, is called an aeon, generator. Her honorific title is the Aeon Sophia. Generically speaking, she is the wisdom goddess. In familiar terms, Pam, the planetary animal mother. And in ritual address, Vivi, flirtatious lightning. Every feature and plot detail of her story is vivid, palpable, and voracious, and all of it can be proven by the test of experience, including correlations to hard science, given that hard science can really say anything correct about the natural world. Wisdom loves the warrior because it is through the warrior that the Aeon Sophia recovers her original purpose and re-engages the Pleroma, the galactic center from which she emerged. She does so in an intervention scenario of the kind prefigured in the 10 avatars of Vishnu. In other words, the Aeon Sophia eventually comes to appear and act in the dream she is dreaming. But due to the particular and anomalous conditions of her cosmological adventure outside the Pleromic core, the opportunity of the wisdom goddess to manifest in her own dream is hampered by special conditions that enmesh her deeply with humanity, her pet species, and bind her into undue preoccupation with the human world. The precise elucidation of these conditions belongs to the ongoing practice of the GNE, the Gaian Navigation Experiment. The challenge Sophia faces right now, namely to effectuate her awakening in the lucid dream and assume self-navigation by her own power, freed of blind capture by the celestial mechanics of the solar system, can be understood by taking the 10 avatars of Vishnu as a prompt, a narrative cue to her situation. She is not Vishnu, and no literal equation of cosmic agencies applies here. But something more fascinating is in play. Consider this plot line. The Sophianic vision story recounts events in the galactic center, Pleroma, prior to the emergence of humanity on Earth, and even prior to the existence of the Earth itself. Episode 4 of the sacred narrative describes how the Aeon Sophia and her consort, Thelete, engineered the human design, the Anthropos. Once the phenome of this seminal plasm was calibrated with specific properties, the entire company of Pleromic Aeons projected it outward and embedded it in the nuclear cloud M42, the Orion Nebula. There it nested as a massive mycelium web in the trapezium, a trapezoidal unit of young stars. As the Aeons observed, filaments of the mycelian weave of the anthropic phenome spread out in fine plasma-sheathed tentacles called linga sharira, long sheaths. The propagules of genomic potential carried in these plasmatic filaments stretched across the galactic arm and germinated in favorable planetary settings, rather in the way a fertilized ovum germinates in the wall of a woman's uterus. Included here is a lovely photo of filamentary plasma exuding from the Cygnus Loop Nebula. All in all, the Pleromic Aeons, including Sophia and her consort Thelete, observed the anthropic phenome germinate in 9 world systems previous to this world, giving rise to 9 distinct planetary experiments with strains of humanity derived from the primary and singular matrix embedded in M42. To their alarm, each of these experiments went badly wrong and ended catastrophically, without allowing the human strain in each case to develop to its full potential, as defined by the 7-fold calibration of the human endowment set by Sophia and Thelete. Anthropos 10. The Aeon Sophia is a young and prodigious divinity, about 14, 15 years old when her experimental work began, of course, speaking in aeonic terms. Compared to the elder aeons, who may be imagined as a team of veteran artists, scientists, now in ripe old age, going on 60 to 70 in human terms. The elder aeons had seen countless disastrous planetary scenarios, but Sophia had not seen so many so far. Moreover, she herself, acting in consort with Thelete, had designed the Anthropos, so it was her experiments that were crashing. She witnessed these events helplessly, unable to change the course of events. As a young aeon, she was not practiced in the particular mechanism of cosmic order used by aeons when they wish to intervene in an experiment underway, with the intent to correct it or guide it away from risk toward an optimal performance. Yet she knew of this practice of intervention and perhaps had seen it demonstrated. As she considered the 9 experiments with the Anthropos that went wrong, the Aeon Sophia engaged in an arduous process. She hypothetically inserted herself into each planetary setting and scenario, picturing how she would have set it on the right course had she actually been able to intervene in medias res. But she was not really able to rescue these 9 preceding experiments due to her immaturity and lack of experience in aeonic projections, setting up planetary experiments with the germinal plasm of sentient organisms. She could only rehearse the interventions that she wished to have performed in those 9 experiments in order to divert them from a catastrophic ending. These exercises were rehearsals of events in the past that she could not revisit or replay, something like wishful thinking in retrospect. After making this review of the 9 experiments, however, Sophia began to ponder a 10th propagation of the Anthropos in a planetary laboratory, a scenario that might arise in the future. Doing so, the Aeon applied all her passion, enthymesis, and her divine intention, ennoia, toward a future scenario in which she could really intervene were the anthropic experiment to go badly off course, as it had done in the 9 previous instances which she witnessed in real time. The future strain of humanity she pictured in this intervention scenario could be designated Anthropos 10. The illustration shows bacteria cultured in a petri dish by analogy to life forms arising in a biosphere provided by a planetary body or a planetary laboratory setting. The 9 hypothetical interventions of the Aeon Sophia are like the 9 incarnations of Vishnu in which the dreaming god manifests in his own dream with a salvific effect. These mythical enactments are merely suggestions of massive events that transpired in the passive imagination of the planetary goddess, the Aeon Sophia, as she witnessed the disastrous outcomes of 9 anthropic experiments preceding the one currently underway on Earth. Docetic form, Nirmanakaya. According to Hindu tradition, there is a 10th future incarnation of Vishnu called Kalki. This is not a cosmic event in the past, nor is it a hypothetical intervention that Sophia might have performed. It is a momentous happening in the present historical epoch, ongoing in real time. The coming of Kalki is the palpable, terrestrially enacted intervention of the wisdom goddess in life on Earth right now. Nor did she anticipate other events that have profoundly impacted her situation, such as the arisal of the Archons and the separation of the sexes. In the current situation, her intervention is complicated by the fact that when Sophia initially preconceived the intervention scenario, she did not realize that she herself, as a pleromic aeon, would embody the planetary setting where the experiment to be rescued was unfolding. Hence, the intervention to correct the experiment with Anthropos 10, that would be us, folks, now underway on Earth, cannot be achieved as she originally envisioned it in pre-terrestrial time. For the goddess to come to the rescue of the human species at the last minute in this experiment, special conditions must be provided, coming in part from humanity itself. Here, the illustration shows a typical picturing of Kalki as a warrior mounted on a white horse. The highest challenge of the seer in Gayan Tantra is to read these conditions clearly and prescribe the modifications required for the Aeon Sophia to achieve her original designs and purposes regarding intervention in the current experiment. The seer discovers what common sense would infer. The wisdom goddess has to do double duty. She must first continue her active, imminent dreaming of the Earth and all life that unfolds in the biosphere. Otherwise, all life on this planet, down to the molecular levels, would shrivel and collapse literally overnight. At the same time, the Aeon Sophia must effectuate the intervention scenario as a discrete agent able to move and act in her own dreaming, lucidly awake, in the setting of human activity on the planet. She cannot merely descend from the galactic center in the routine manner of a pleromic avatar, literally one who descends. She cannot descend at all because she is already here. Instead, she has to break out of immersion as a massive planetary body and manifest in the real-time presence of a discrete agent, a character acting in that aspect of her dreaming that interfaces with human history. She who upholds all creatures has to appear as some kind of creature, an animal form or a character resembling a human being, but along the lines of a docetic body, a nirmanakaya, to apply the Buddhist term. Docetic is a Gnostic term from the Greek dokein, meaning to appear. There is then an illustration of Sangye Nyenpa Rinpoche, example of a living Tibetan master considered to be a nirmanakaya, hence regarded and treated with exceptional deference and reverence. Defined in a conventional sense, the nirmanakaya is the physical body of a Buddha manifesting in the world to teach the Dharma and bring all beings to enlightenment. For example, the historical Buddha is so considered. The nirmanakaya body is subject to sickness, old age, and death like any other living creature. More accurately, however, a nirmanakaya is an emanation body or form of magical apparition, perceived to be an ordinary physical body, but not actually so. Hence the precise meaning of a docetic form, comparable to a hologram. There follows another illustration of a female bodhisattva in the Chinese style, a Kuan Yin. Such images suggest forms taken by pleromic aeons in intervention scenarios. But strictly speaking, such an incarnate divinity, in quotes, is holographic rather than physical. Hence, this figure exhibits the special allure of a dream body, composed of sublime and appealing features, sense and organs, and beautiful, elegant properties and features, and devoid of corruptible physical traits found in human bodies. It is highly probable, reckoning from historical studies of the origins of Buddhism by Snellgrove and others, that Indian Buddhists developed the notion of the bodhisattva who may assume a nirmanakaya body from contact with Gnostics of the mystery school sometime in the 2nd century CE. This was the moment of the emergence of the bodhisattva ideal, most likely a reflection or borrowing from the foster or illuminated teacher of the mysteries. It is also the moment of the appearance of the Prajnaparamita or Supreme Wisdom scriptures, which clearly mirror Gnostic teachings on Sophia, the wisdom goddess. However, when they incorporated these notions into Buddhism, the Asian cousins of the Levantine Gnostics gave them a literal spin. They turned the docetic form of an avatar into a literal incarnation, whereas Gnostics denied, for instance, that putative saviors, such as Jesus, could have assumed full incorporation. To this day, Buddhism, in its many variants, continues, as far as I know, to apply a concrete spin, that is, to reify the bodhisattva nirmanakaya, rather than to recognize the power of its purely docetic or apparitional nature. The nirmanakaya Kuan Yin, as pictured here, would be closer to the suprahuman perfection of a docetic figure than to a flesh and blood person, like the Rinpoche pictured above her. Third illustration is from a ninja girl in a Japanese manga. In the archontified world of the end of Kali Yuga, images of the docetic vehicle or nirmanakaya float up into the collective mind in caricatures slanted and colored by the filters of electronic media and IT. The illustration here shows a version of such figures as occurs in the Japanese manga, often starring a ninja girl gifted with occult powers. In computer jargon, an avatar is a fictional identity one creates on the internet. Often the human author of the avatar represents this alternative identity by a cartoon or CGI, a computer-generated image. The slick, archontic look, the corporal streamlining, and the antiseptic feel of such images is unmistakable and can be strangely captivating. This look assumes extreme form in CGI pornography and robotized polyurethane sex dolls, particularly favored among Japanese men, who are widely known to be totally off sexual intercourse with actual women. That is to say, unable to face the biological and chemical aspects of sexuality, the dicey parts, the gamey sense, the secretions, and so forth. The flawless plasticity of women in CGI porn and their life-size counterparts, which are interactive sex dolls, presents an intimation of docetic form, as would be assumed by the Aeon Sophia in the perceptual field of the archontified awareness of humankind. In other words, the imagery of archontic deviance from human imperfection, tending toward a streamlined antiseptic version of the human form, points toward, or may point toward, a supernatural event in the making. It may be that the sleek, iconic imagery of Japanese mangas prefigures in some way the appearance that the wisdom goddess would assume as Kalki, i.e., the anatomically streamlined female ninja warrior. Time out here for a second while I add a verbal note to the text. Be clear and be especially mindful of what I'm saying here. I'm saying that it may be that the agent of intervention, the Kalki avatar, which is Sophia herself appearing in her lucid dream, it may be that it assumes this form, which actually is an archontified form, an anatomically streamlined, antiseptic replica of a human form. Well, why would the Aeon Sophia choose, if she is able to produce and manifest this intervention in its docetic form, why would she choose to represent it in this manner, perhaps indistinguishable from an archontic form? Why would she, as it were, adopt the style of the archons for her avataric presence? I leave you with that question. And if I can remember what I'm doing for the next 20 minutes, I'll come back to it at the end of this reading. To continue, duplex orchestration. Above, we noted that Sophia has to do two things at once if she is to intervene in the divine experiment now underway. In the jargon of Gaian Echo Sorcery, this exceptionally demanding feat of double duty, working back and forth from tonal to nahual, is called duplex orchestration. Normally, a nahual who enters the supernatural returns with magical knowledge and power, or tools or secrets or cues, which he or she then applies to the ordinary world, the tonal, doing so by teaching or transmitting, or by using a set of occult strategies or symbolic dramatic enactments called orchestrations of fate. In this process, the sorcerer deploys the imaginative power of the supernatural in the situations of ordinary life. A dicey and delicate operation, I can assure you of that. Usually orchestration proceeds from the nawal to the tonal, directed from the non-ordinary into ordinary life. Thus, the nahual of Gayan sorcery impacts ordinary life with the powers and intentions and schemes drawn from the supernatural, especially from the realm of the cosmic Shakti, the divine feminine. Gayan tantric magic with the Shakti cluster is a practice of orchestrating fate in this manner. But a shaman sorcerer can also perform this impacting technique in the other direction, taking orchestration from the ordinary into the non-ordinary, from the tonal into the nahual. To do both simultaneously is duplex orchestration. Due to the unanticipated conditions of the Anthropos 10 experiment, now underway, for which the Aeon Sophia is herself the setting, or planetary habitat, the wisdom goddess must perform a feat of duplex orchestration, working both ways at once. But she cannot do so without a strategic degree of human participation. She can, by herself, bring the non-ordinary into the ordinary, orchestrating the nahual into the tonal. She can pour the beauty and magic of the Shakti cluster into the atmosphere of the earth and into the collective psyche of humanity purely by the autonomous force of her will, Anoya. And that is exactly what she is doing as she establishes the initial conditions of correction since March 2011. But she alone cannot bring the ordinary into the non-ordinary, orchestrating the tonal into the nahual. For that, she needs a strategic degree of human coordination. Understand this tricky proposition, and you realize the dilemma facing the wisdom goddess in the challenge to achieve her pre-envisioned intervention at the precise moment when humanity faces maximum risk of annihilation, wiping itself out. We are currently facing that exact moment. The second Kalki. According to Hindu tradition, Kalki, which is misspelled Kali in the text, it should be Kalki. Kalki signifies the male warrior aspect of Kali, a female deity who represents the wrath of the cosmic Shakti or Divine Mother. Interesting concept here. The male warrior aspect of a female warrior impulse, the rage of the Divine Mother. You may wonder if gender matters at all in such mythic propositions or how it can signify anything of value to our understanding of these matters. May the Turton assure you that yes, it matters supremely. Recall that human cooperation in Sophia's intervention depends upon understanding the specific conditions of that event, seen in the perspective of her original preview in the Pleroma before the Earth existed. Due to the contrast between what she planned to do before the Earth arose and what she has to do now that she herself is embodied in the Earth, the original scheme for intervention has to be adapted, modified. How so? Let's say that originally Sophia envisioned herself in a typical avataric descent as she had perhaps seen demonstrated by elder pleromic aeons. She would then take on a docetic form or Nimanakaya body. She would not incarnate through the biological process of reproduction nor occupy a body that had been born in that manner. Aeons do not incarnate in that manner. In the docetic form, she would intervene in history as a single figure, the female warrior aspect of Kali. But wait, that would be a woman. Kali is always depicted in female form. But Kalki is to be understood as male, a figure of the masculine gender of our species. So what's up? At this point, it helps enormously to review the Andromedan version of the Greco-Latin myth of Perseus and Andromeda. In the classical earthbound version of that myth, the male warrior Perseus, name meaning the one who destroys, rescues the chained woman, Andromeda. Here the intervening hero is clearly male, the subject to be rescued, female. But that is a patriarchal spin, we might suppose, on the version of the myth preserved for us in another form in the contemplation of our Andromedan doubles, the control group of this, our current terrestrial experiment. In Andromedan eyes, Perseus becomes Kali, the female warrior form of Sophia, while Andromeda represents humanity itself. This conversion of the classical myth indicates the terms of the original pact Sophia made with that strain of the Anthropos that she had envisioned in an experiment designed by her unilateral dreaming without a consort. Perseus Kali is definitely a female agent according to those original terms, but corrected in the perspective of our Andromedan doubles, this male patriarchal figure turns into the female Kalki. But who then is the male warrior aspect of Kali? Considering Sophia's need to adapt her intervention to the unanticipated conditions of her planetary embodiment, her rescue scenario requires a second Kali. This is Kalki of the male gender. Now, this scramble between Kali and Kalki can be confusing. So, I'm adding a note here, folks. So I just ask you to go gently with it. Hold it lightly in your mind. Let it float. And don't fixate too strongly on the scenario, trying to understand it or trying to rationally pin it down. Let it float. And then in the way that it floats, it will take form and definition in your imagination. To continue reading the text, to comprehend this startling option, let's allow that the intervention originally presumed by Sophia must now, due to the unanticipated conditions of her experiment, including the shearing of the Anthropos template, or separation of the sexes, the intervention must be undertaken in two parts rather than one. Compare the current rescue scenario to that kind of glue that comes in two vials and only works when the chemicals in each vial are combined. The female Perseus Kali agent of intervention can act alone, for sure, but it cannot achieve its goal on its own. It requires a counterpart, a male warrior ally. This is the second Kalki. Sophia herself provides the originally intended figure of intervention, that is, an Amanakaya or docetic vehicle. By this strategy, she can orchestrate from the Nahual into the Tonal. But to orchestrate from the Tonal, the world of ordinary humanity, into the Nahual, another player must be provided for her. The second Kalki enacts the reversing phase of Sophia's duplex orchestration, now directing the magic from the Tonal to the Nahual. The illustration here shows a typical Hindu rendering of Kalki. Some representations of the Kalki avatar show a white horse with no rider, suggesting the question, who is missing? Why is the white horse riderless? Who shall be mounted on this horse? This imagery is consistent with the challenge facing humanity today to restore honor to manhood in the fullest possibility of genuine virile power that can be imagined. The haunting image of the riderless horse points exactly to what is missing in the current closing chapter of the world drama. The second, Kalki, the wrath of Gaia Sophia in its male gendered expression. Until that happens, the honor of man is a riderless horse. There is a subtle but all-important shift of strategy entailed here. Dreaming from the Pleroma, Sophia pictured herself as Kalki, yes, but as a female-gendered agent of avataric potency. In the actuality of this historical moment, Sophia can manifest as that Kalki of her original dreaming. Sure, but to achieve her original aim, she requires the seconding of another power, the male Kaleka warrior, the second Kalki. In other words, Vivi herself is Kali Kalki of the female gender, seconded and assisted by a Kaleka warrior of male gender. The presence and cooperation of the second Kali Kalki, embodied in the male warrior, is the unique adaptation that the goddess requires to achieve her intervention. Next is an illustration of the Andromeda constellation linked to the great square of Pegasus. According to some interpretations, the white horse of Pegasus can be identified with the Kalki avatar. It leaps from the head star of Andromeda, Alpheretz, which locates a corner of the great square of Pegasus, which may be called the portal of wonder. To add another little note here, I notice as I'm reading through this text in the last couple of pages that I had written Kali, where I ought to have written Kalki. I'm not talking about the second Kali, although it is the second Kali, but I'm really talking about the second Kalki, the male Kalki. And so I will forthwith make those corrections in this text, and they will be represented accurately by the time this recording is uploaded on Gaiaspora. To continue, we come to the section headed Guarding Manhood. So who exactly is the second Kalki, the male warrior aspect of Kali? Be assured that this is most certainly not a single person, a single human male hero, a single man living on Earth. How do I know that fact with such certainty? Because the identity of the second Kalki can be derived from the clue contained in the mysterious name, Andromeda. To the bafflement of scholars and mythologists, the Greek name Andromeda means the one who guards the man or guards manhood. The Greek word andros means man, the masculine gender, contrasted to anthropos, humanity, which comprises both genders. And, of course, the Greek word for woman is gynae. Now, it is extremely odd that Andromeda, the female victim, in quotes, to be rescued by Perseus, is called by a name meaning the one who guards manhood. In that name looms a huge question. Well, who does guard manhood? What on earth does it mean to guard manhood, anyway? Consider the granular detail of this myth, with particular attention to the gender roles, of extreme importance, I must emphasize, and hold clearly to the Andromedan version, and the riddle unravels. The female warrior, Kali, intervenes to rescue the one who guards manhood. But to do so, she needs the assistance of a male warrior counterpart. Recalling that the one who guards manhood is humanity itself, do you now see the decisive twist in this plot? The decisive feat of strategy. For the human species of Anthropos 10, to be rescued by Sophia's intervention, Sophia as Kali must pair with a male warrior who is guarded by the very people to be rescued. In some manner, those people in the world today who, quote, guard manhood, allow the male warrior counterpart, the second Kalki, to enact the crucial role of seconding Sophia in her modified rescue scenario. Run this plot in your mind a few times, and if you can get the hang of it, you will glimpse the terms of the fully modified intervention scenario as it might now be held in contemplation of our Andromedan doubles. The illustration in the text subtitled Honor Returning shows a modern portrait of a Lakota warrior from a beautiful site, Spirit of the Lake People. For our cooperation in Sophia's intervention, directing the tonal into the nahual, a lot depends on how we understand the identity of Andromeda, the one who guards manhood. But wait, Andromeda is humanity itself. Well, yes, but not exactly. To be more precise, Andromeda is that part of humanity that guards manhood. In other words, the part that honors honor, that keeps manhood alive, and recognizes the true nature of virility and protects it from extinction. Manhood is the seat of honor, and honor allows for the noble use of violent force in the cause of life, freedom, and beauty. If manhood is lost, humanity itself is lost from that particular side of our mortal equation, from the side of the male gender. So let me add this note for further clarification of this most important proposition. Without the recognition of true manhood in a society, the male members of that society who elect to be warriors and heroes cannot exercise the noble use of violent force in the cause of life, freedom, and beauty. Therefore, those members of society who give the warrior that recognition and thereby support his use of violent force in a sacred manner are those who guard humanity, those who guard the manhood of our species. In the current moment, when the coming of Kalki is imminent, the burning question before us is, who among people living today guards, preserves, protects, and fosters true manhood in the men of this world? It could be said that whoever does so, be it man or woman, belongs to the Andromeda core of the human species. I was thinking about like the Peace Corps folks, you know. Oh, this is not the Peace Corps. There you stand if you recognize the honor of manhood, an act to uphold and preserve it. Not all human beings living in the world today belong to that class, the Andromedan core. But those who do can literally, and in a very real historical sense, be rescued by the men whose manhood they recognize and preserve. In the current global scenario, it is primarily men who are charged with the task to carry out the orders of the globalist predators and psychopaths. If these men stand down and refuse to carry out these orders, then global catastrophe might be averted, stopping in its tracks. Men who carry out the agenda of the arch predators act without honor in a disgusting and dishonoring manner. But if a man chooses to act against orders coming from the authorities who aim to enslave and annihilate the human species, honor is restored in that single case. Of course, women in the chain of command directed by the globalist psychopaths can also stand down, and some may do so now in a most decisive manner. But actions undertaken by the male archetype of honor are the crucial factor here. The Kalika warrior archetype can also be enacted by a woman, and in some decisive instances right now may very well be. But all in all, it is the honor of men that will preponderantly decide the outcome of the present global nightmare. Now ask yourself, where are the men of honor today? Who are they? And what are they doing to defeat the dishonorable and disgusting actions of the psychotics and psychopaths who have duped humanity into playing out their nightmare? Where are the real men in this world today? Do you know one? Are you one? The granular detail of the Sophianic intervention narrative, especially the precision of the gender roles, clearly reveals that some people living today must recognize and guard true manhood if they are to be beneficiaries of heroic actions aligned to the wrath of Gaia, enacted by Kali. The Aeon Sophia needs the heroic action of men to achieve her intervention. But men have to be, in turn, recognized in the enactment of their honor. The second Kalki is not a single man, but the entire male contingent attached to Sophia's Nirmanakaya vehicle of wrath. The second Kali Kalki is the summed force of Kalika warriors of male gender. By contrast, Kalika warriors of the female gender are the summed expression of the Matangi aspect of the planetary animal mother. This distinction is absolutely critical for an effective strategy of spiritual engagement in Gayan Tantra following the triple formula of love, war, and magic. I have a lot to say about it in the immediate future. At the 51-minute mark, I come to the closing passage of this text titled Eye of the Bull. To see the heroic in man and restore manhood to its rightful level of efficacy in the world today is absolutely crucial to the great turnaround that looms before us right now, viewed with an extremely short window of opportunity. Women who come to recognize the heroic in man so that men can reclaim their honor and act in behalf of all humanity. This is the formula. This is the strategy. Only with such recognition to guard them can men succeed in counteracting the globalist psychotics and psychopaths, the interspecies predators who would drag the entire planet to ruin in their nightmare of deceit, division, and domination. The illustration from a Sumerian cylinder seal shows the new king replacing the old in the presence of the goddess. This is a Babylonian engraving from Sumer around 2300 BC. Worthiness to be king was tested in the Hieros Gamos, or sacred mating, an erotic ritual conducted by a priestess of the great goddess Ishtar or Inanna. The candidate for king showed his qualification by two performances, correctly anticipating the desires of the priestess, rather than just doing as he wanted with her, and surrendering totally to the exquisite pleasure she conferred upon him in flagrant acts of sexual affection. For a full poetic account of this rite, see drushara.com. As now, so was it then. In the ancient past, before the rise of theocracy, the main instrument of patriarchal domination, priestesses of the great goddess tested men in the rite of sacred mating. The purpose of these erotic rites was to prove the vulnerability and tenderness of the man, especially his capacity for surrender. No man was deemed capable to be king or tribal chieftain who did not demonstrate total surrender to a woman in the throes of sexual pleasure, and no way of faking it. Traditionally, men carry the responsibility to use violent force to protect life. This responsibility is the criterion of true manhood by which honor is preserved. But for a man to preserve his honor, he needs the recognition of those whom he serves with honorable actions. In the deplorable situation of our time, members of the military and police forces have been brainwashed into the betrayal of honor in the service of authorities such as the federal government. Consequently, they do not protect humanity or their families and loved ones, as they may naively believe, but they protect those who intend harm, destruction, deceit, and death to most of the human race. Such is the tragedy of manhood in our time. Kali is the wrath of the wisdom goddess. She is the first Kalki. The second Kalki is the reborn warrior spirit of humanity, rallied to support the wisdom goddess as she awakens in her own dreaming, so that she can achieve intervention that she predetermined for this current situation, the experiment of Anthropos 10, which is the 10th strain of human germ plasm in this galaxy. In the current course of events, the Aeon Sophia remembers in her own way the sacred pact of woman and man commemorated in the erotic rituals by her priestesses of old. As she does so, we of the human species face the rare and fleeting opportunity to recover the consecrating power of that pact in our own way, on our own terms, in our own lives, here and now, and to remake the pact. In the spring of 2012, an omen appears in the evening sky toward the west, the conjunction of Venus and Jupiter. On March 19th, the first anniversary of the onset of correction, these two bright planets converge closely for all the world to see, high in the sky after sunset. As the year proceeds, Jupiter moves to conjunction with Aldebaran, the star marking the eye of the bull. It does so through late July into August. The bull constellation is the supreme display of the erotic power and beauty of the Earth goddess. Oddly, the bull does not and never did represent masculine energy, macho power, or the brutal thrust of procreative loins. Nothing like that. It represents the empowerment of man through the goddess and for the benefit of humankind, not manpower on its own blind and brutal terms. Consider that distinction with great care, if you will. Continuing into November of 2012, the lunar apogee, located in the ram at the time I write this text, also reaches the bull and aligns to Aldebaran. Hence, from March through November 2012, humanity faces the opportunity to enact a mythical ritual of consecration with the aim of recovering the honor of men. The Aeon Sophia herself would experience this event in a correlative phase of her recapitulation, healing the gender rift that she herself caused when she inadvertently sheared the Anthropos template. Crew notes and talks posted on Gaiaspora.org throughout 2012 cover these developments in real time. As noted in a recent talk, rescue by the wisdom goddess is not comparable to any other such presumed act of divine intervention typically found in the salvationist religions. In those scenarios, intervention is scripted from beforehand and carried out by an unfailing omnipotence of the male creator God. It cannot fail. It entirely prevails over all human activity, and it operates exclusively from a superhuman dynamic. Not so with the intervention of the Aeon Sophia. It requires human participation to succeed, and it may fail, for its outcome is not guaranteed even by the Pleromic Aeons. That concludes the written text posted on metahistory.org. Now that brings this recording exactly to the 60-minute mark. And that's very convenient because I would like to add 5 or 10 minutes of additional commentary. Let me be as exact and succinct as I can be. I bring your attention vividly to 4 points. The first point is that at the time this text was written, I anticipated the shift of the lunar apogee into the bull, where it would pass or conjunct with the Pleiades, as well as the passage of Jupiter into the bull. But that at that moment, in March of 2012, I did not anticipate that we would see, during the summer of 2012, the achievement of pleromic relay. So there you go. This is what it's like being on board a living planet in a laboratory experiment that unfolds imaginatively and existentially in real time. So now I can say, and you can all recognize, those of you in the GNE, that the conditions have been provided due to pleromic relay, or let me not speak in the passive voice. The establishment of pleromic relay in the summer of 2012, culminating, I believe, on the 7th of September, now presents a support and realignment of the Aeon Sophia with the galactic core. That being so, I can modify the last line of my text. The intervention of the Aeon Sophia, which requires a human participation to succeed, may indeed fail, but at least we are assured that the full participation of the pleromic aeons is in effect. And so, although the pleromic aeons may not be able to guarantee the outcome of this, of the fate of Anthropos 10 in this kalpa, they are certainly deeply engaged with Sophia's correction. This is something that I could not have said or seen in March of 2012. The three remaining points are as follows. I wrote something that I need to repeat, that I myself forgot almost instantly when I wrote it. Referring back to the text, I reread this paragraph, the final paragraph before the heading entitled Eye of the Bull. Quote, the second Kalki is not a single man, but the entire male contingent of Kalika warriors attached to Sophia's Nirmanakaya vehicle of wrath. The second Kalki is the summed force of Kalika warriors of the male gender. By contrast, Kalika warriors of the female gender are the summed expression of the Matangi aspect of the planetary animal mother. This distinction is absolutely critical for an effective strategy of spiritual engagement in Gayan Tantra following the triple formula of love, war, and magic. I have a lot to say about it in the immediate future. End quote. Well, here I am, back and saying something about it now. And why am I saying something about it now? The paragraph I just read is probably, even to my mind, one of the most astounding statements of Gayan Tantric sorcery that has come forth from the main Turton. This proposition, aligning men, the summed force of Kalika warriors of the male gender, to Kali, and aligning the summed force of Kalika warriors of the female gender to Matangi, is impeccable, and you can take it to the bank. This is now, I see today, in the fourth or fifth day of the Matangi shift, I see how true that is, which I wrote in those words. When I resume the nav briefings, I am going straight to this proposition. In order to round off this current recording, here are the two remaining points. At the time I posted this essay, I was not aware, as I am now, of how much of the material indicated in this essay, how much of the telestic and strategic intel, as it were, would come to be concretized and developed much more fully during the period of the lunar apogee in the bull and Jupiter in the bull, especially in proximity to Aldebaran. So what we are currently living through from the end of 2012 into the first couple of months of 2013 is actually the conditions in the cosmic environment that reflect the achievement of what I've indicated in this essay of about 10 months ago. And the two points I want to make first concern the operations of the male warriors who use violence in a sacred manner, and the question of the archontic form assumed by the Kalki avatar in its female aspect. So, to cut to the chase here, what I'm really saying, I can see now what I was saying in this essay relates closely to what I intimated in my last talk with Red Ice. In that talk, in the second part, I said that the human animal has been divinely designed to excel in violence. Now, the fact is today that there is a great deal of violence happening on this planet, and it is not of an excellent kind. You know, the Greek word for excellence is arete, A-R-E-T-E, and arete was a criterion of the teleste. What the teleste wished to do in the teaching they offered in the mystery schools and in the extension of the mystery cells into the university environment was to bring the human potential to the level of arete, or excellence. Just as you would wish to bring your talents, whatever they may be, to a level of excellence, we must consider bringing the human talent for violence to a level of excellence. To have the massive, blind, greed-driven, deceit-driven violence operating on the planet today is not an example of that excellence. But in order for some men, some male animals of the human species, to achieve that excellence in the expression of violence as a sacred calling of man, well, consent is required. No man, no group of men can do that in the human community without the consent of the people they are protecting. I really want you to contemplate this problem. It's a problem of consent. And what I now see as I reread my own words is that everything I wrote at that time was pointing to the situation we face now, which is culminating in the spring of 2013. Both the male warrior Kalikas and the female warrior Kalikas, aligned to Kali and Matanga respectively, now can begin and must begin to stand side by side and so shoulder to shoulder to face what is probably going to be the ultimate assault of the Archons upon humanity in the spring of 2013. And coming to the nature of that ultimate assault, I come to the final point of my verbal addition to this reading. Why would the Aeon Sophia choose an archonified form, something like a Japanese manga, something like a CGI image of the human body, Why would she assume that kind of form to achieve her avataric intervention? Well, I just want to point out something to you, my friends, those of you who are allies in the crew and those of you who are drawn toward the Kalika role of sacred war, the Kalika challenge to mount the counter magic to the satanic magic operating against humanity. I would say to you that the event called the Sandy Hook Massacre took place on the first day of the Kurukula shift of 2012, December 14th. And since the first day of the Matangi shift of 2012, which began on January 12th, I have spent a great deal of time considering what actually happened in that event. And I have come to the conclusion, to certain conclusions about that event, which I will hold off until I can elaborate them more carefully in the next NAB briefing. But I would just plant this germ in your minds, if I may. Whatever happened in that schoolhouse, and whatever happened or did not happen to those children, the way that the event has been portrayed and presented to the world is so full of obvious fakery that it becomes impossible to tell if the fakery is real or if the fakery is even being faked. It is impossible to tell, to put it in another way, if the hoax of the Sandy Hook Massacre is simply the cover of an actual massacre that occurred, or if it is the description of a massacre that actually didn't occur, but that the world is being led to believe did occur. It is impossible to tell. And when human perception has been so far distorted by the archontic powers, and I intend to talk in the next NAB briefing about actually how this has come about, when human perception, generally speaking, when the faculties of the human animal have been so distorted and undermined by archontic powers that we cannot tell fakery from real, that is the moment when the Aeon Sophia can use archonic forms to achieve her intervention. Now, I wish to point out, and some of you will be extremely relieved to hear me say this, that it is not only through an archontic, iconic, manga-like Nirmanakaya that she would intervene. It is not just in that way, because she also intervenes through her animal powers, through the white birds, the white owl, the white whales, the white buffalo, the white lions, and the possum, the humble white possum. She also intervenes through the vehicles of her animal powers. You can bet on that. But the particular and central figure of intervention is her own self-generated persona in the lucid dream of this nightmare. And that persona, she gives a streamlined archontic form precisely because the way to shatter the archontic powers is to use their own strategy against them. So on that note, I conclude this recording. I wish you all well and safe passage. And I am eager to be back again with you soon.